Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett, and we begin, as usual, with our WFPL news team and the developments from the past week in Louisville and beyond. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama all here. Welcome back, folks.
Hey. Good to be here. Hey.
We, of course, welcome your input on the topics we discussed during this program. 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255, or you can call us toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK. 877-814-8255. You can email us at news@wfpl.org. Send us a tweet at WFPL News or reach us through Facebook. And we're going to talk a little later with Kentucky Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, but as most legislative business affects us here locally, there's some overlap in our coverage. I do want to point out that Philip M. Bailey, that we just learned that Governor Steve Beshear has signed this somewhat controversial redistricting bill.
Yeah, the governor, to give people a background, earlier this week, the state legislator passed what was considered to be a pretty controversial redistricting plan for House and state Senate seats here in Kentucky. No one seemed to really be pleased by this. Depending on who you talk to, they were upset about different things. Some House Republicans were mad because some incumbents are having to run against some GOP challengers the way things were set up. But the most controversial and probably thing that upset people the most was the fact that State Senator Kathy Stein of Lexington, a Democrat out of Lexington, her seat was moved altogether. She will have to either move to run for that seat again or just wait 2 years. So she says she will not move. So many of her supporters were pressuring and lobbying the governor to veto the legislation outright to save Stein's seat. Stein is considered the most liberal member of the state Senate. She's been a pretty consistent critic of State Senate President David Williams. She accused Williams of doing this deliberately. Senate Republicans denied that altogether. State Senator Damon Thayer said that there was no politics involved in the way the maps were drawn. But clearly people point out the fact that, you know, Stein was forced, her district was being moved to, I believe, a whole different part of the state, considering that it represented part of downtown Lexington. So the governor signed that, and he did decry the process, saying that it was not only a partisanship, but a personal vindictiveness involved, what he saw in it, involving State Senator Stein. So this will leave Stein's position open to where her many options are, whether she wants to file a lawsuit challenging the redistricting map altogether in the courts or running for her old House seat. The one thing she says is off the table is her running for her current seat by moving. She would have to move to run for that seat. So she says that's off the table, but this sort of puts this issue behind us pretty quickly. The governor making a pretty straightforward decision.
So time was of the essence here, too, because we have a filing deadline coming up.
Yeah, right? And that's what the governor cited in his statement, saying that, you know, we only have 11 days until candidates can file for House, State House and State Senate seats. That sort of took precedent, but still many of her supporters were very adamant through blogs, Facebook, and others lobbying the governor. I know that his spokesperson was saying that they were up to their eyeballs in redistricting. The lines, the phone calls to the governor's office were pretty much jammed up. So this was something that people feel pretty adamant about, and I guess will remain an issue, at least for Stein supporters, in the next couple of weeks, if not months.
He seemed to say in his statement I just read a while ago, so I'll sign this, but next time let's watch the partisanship, okay?
And the conversation has started lightly around the idea that maybe a third party should be redrawing the districts in the first place, maybe not necessarily the people who would benefit from the way the seats are drawn, which is the politicians themselves. So the governor hinted at that at the end. No clear decision on whether we will come up with a commission or anything to do that, but certainly when a situation like this happens, people every 10 years, everyone promises, well, we'll remove the partisanship from it, but we wait another 9 years and we'll be back here in 2020 or right. 2000, whatever.
All right. Thank you, Philip. Devin Katayama, seems like every budget cycle, the governor proposes cuts to higher education funding. That was the case this week with Governor Beshear's budget address, which we'll talk more detail about with our Kentucky Public Radio correspondent. That's the case this time, and administrators at the University of Louisville are reacting.
Yeah, and higher education was actually cut 6.4%. This standard agency was cut around 8.4%. So they did spare them those 2%. But every time you make any kind of cut, you know, schools budget for a certain amount, and they expect a certain amount. So you take some away, it's taken steps back, not forward. Mr. Ramsey, President Ramsey of UL President, said that it's likely tuition will increase again. They've done this for the past several years, and those tuition caps are set by the Council on Post-Secondary Education. Now, for research universities, they're usually set higher, so 6% has been the last year the cap that the university can set the tuition rate as. So they're still figuring that out. They're going to be talking with post-secondary education over the next few months to determine what that rate cap is going to be, but that's likely coming down the road.
Okay, and are they talking about any other projects that might be in jeopardy because of this, or still too early to tell?
Well, they requested a certain amount of projects be issued, bonds be issued this year. The Governor Beshear did approve $50 million worth of bonds that the university can use for various projects. They have three projects in mind for that $50 million. One is going to be to expand the Student Activity Center. Another is going to be to build a new entryway to the campus on the northeast corner near I-65. And then another is going towards a contract it has with Siemens, which is hired to install energy-saving systems around the campus. So that was kind of something that they hoped and received from the governor. And now if you look at UK got $200 million worth of bonds approved, $175 for the Rupp Arena as well. So schools got various amounts. U of L kind of got on the lower amount, but they asked for not as much. So that's why they got the $50 million.
All right. Thanks, Devin. Erica Peterson, WFPL Environment Reporter, you reported. We started talking about this late last week, but we haven't talked about it on this program, that the state beekeeper has been fired. Well, some folks might say, well, okay, so what? But why is this significant?
Well, it's significant in a couple of different ways, I think. For one, bees are very important, even for people who don't keep bees or rely on their honey. They pollinate crops in the states and they kind of keep the whole agricultural sector going. So the state beekeeper is actually a very important position in charge of basically making sure that being a resource to beekeepers to help them keep their hives healthy and things like that. So that's one thing. Another thing is that it's kind of odd, and it's been greeted as kind of odd by many in the bee community, that this was a politically appointed position. Mm-hmm. It's not something you think of normally being
no.
being a politically appointed position. So that's kind of odd as well.
What's the reaction been to this?
Well, there's been a lot of outcry from the bee community. The beekeeper, the state apiarist, was Phil Kraft, who was a very well-respected beekeeper nationally and in the state. He'd been in his position for about 12 years. He served under Democratic and Republican agricultural commissioners. And he wasn't... he wasn't really given any reason for his dismissal, but the new agricultural commissioner, Republican James Comer, did lay off 16 people pretty much on his second day of work. And his spokeswoman said he's not eliminating the state apiary position, but he wants to get his own people in there.
And you say beekeeping community, and that is a you say that with a straight face, because there is a very strong beekeeping community, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, and it's not something you normally would think about. But there are. I mean, there's kind of a burgeoning urban beekeeping thing going on in Kentucky, as well as a lot of rural beekeepers. There are projects to put bees and trees they pollinate on former strip mining sites, and it's a huge deal. They even in California, where there are lots of crops like almonds and fruits that need to be pollinated, it's a pretty big business where they ship bees in from places inside the country to pollinate these crops. And people who are involved on a bigger scale participate in stuff like that. But even just a backyard beekeeper, can make money and as well as make sure the plants they're growing are doing well.
All right, thanks, Erica. Gabe Buller, will turn to you and talk about roads. Because the governor has been touting his plan for highways in Kentucky this week, and you reported on how the plan will affect us here in Louisville.
Yeah, the highway plan comes out with every budget, and it's prone to some amendments and changes from the General Assembly. But for the most part, I talked with some folks at the Transportation Cabinet. They say it largely stays intact. The governor, he's out touting this plan. He met with some officials in Lexington recently to talk about some of the details in it. There are two big priorities that affect Louisville, and these are two large priorities for the plan overall. One is to widen I-65 to six lanes from border to border, from the Tennessee border to the Indiana border here in Louisville. It's four lanes. If you drive to Nashville, it does go down to four lanes for part of it. This is one of the major corridors of the highways in Kentucky, and it's one that the state wants to have to be six lanes, not only to move goods around between the area around Fort Knox and Louisville, but to move goods from Tennessee to Indiana and and vice versa, which is fairly important. Also, there's the plan sets aside $50 million a year for 6 years to build another part of I-65, but the Ohio River Bridges project. This project was split between Indiana and Kentucky. Indiana's building the East End Bridge and the everything associated with that. Kentucky is handling the downtown portion, which would add another bridge next to the Kennedy and rework Spaghetti Junction. It's going to be $1.3 billion. So there's this $50 million a year for 6 years, and then about $230 million in what are called Garvey bonds, and then the rest of that money, it's $536 million, is called for to be paid with toll bonds, which will end up being tolls on that bridge when it's built.
Is there a target completion date for any of these projects, or the widening and so forth?
Yeah, there are some in the budget, but Chuck Wolf with the Transportation Cabinet says those can change depending on what happens. The I-65 project is going to take about 6 years or so. It's going to cost about $500 million, a little bit less than that, and that one's a little more concrete. The Bridges project, this $1.3 billion, there's still a lot of details to work out, and that's one thing that Chuck Wolf was stressing when I talked with him. He said, you know, a lot of it depends on what the Bridges Authority does. Some of it depends on what Indiana's doing. And so while they hope to begin work later this year, it's still not clear how that's going to work and if they'll follow that timeline exactly for these grants and for tolls.
All right. Thank you, Gabe. Philip M. Bailey, we've been a lot of talk. We've reported quite a bit in the last year or so about the problem of vacant properties around the Louisville area. Now in the Metro Council, some details are emerging about a committee to address the problem.
Yes, earlier this year, after being elected to a second consecutive term as council president, Councilman Jim King announced that when he proposed the leaders of different committees on the council, three new ad hoc committees, one dealing with the Land Development Code, one dealing with franchise agreements, and one dealing with vacant properties, which has been an issue that the council has really sunk its teeth into for the past year and a half, 2 years. People might remember when the council put out that list of vacant delinquent property owners, people who still owe fines or liens to the city. This committee will be chaired by Councilman Kelly Downard, Republican out of the East End, who former mayoral candidate himself and a former banker, so someone who knows the financial situation with a lot of these banks and how the process works. It will be the vice chair of that committee will be newly appointed Councilwoman Attica Woodson Scott of District 1, a Democrat out of West Louisville. So you see just with the committee leaders that there will be sort of a diverse background as far as the committee is concerned. I talked to Councilwoman Scott earlier this week. She said that one of the things she wants this committee to do is not just to investigate the problem, but actually draft some resolutions and or legislation that will push the state to put the city further up the totem pole than it already is. People may remember last year that the city so did leap ahead as far as how who can get the fines and how it can get those fines and maybe crack down on delinquent property owners or abandoned properties a little bit better. She wants some pretty clear-cut legislation that will allow them to do that. And I think you'll see as committee members begin to join, I think Councilman Sherbright Hamilton has shown interest in being a part of that committee, you'll see that issue and that discussion expand not only with investigations in that committee but also what the mayor's administration is doing, what the state can do, and what the city can do more to address a problem. Because in some neighborhoods, particularly Russell, Parkland, you see 15% to 20% of the homes in certain neighborhoods are abandoned or vacant.
It was a Councilwoman Scott that invited Mayor Fisher to go on like a ride-along of her district to look at the condition of things?
Yeah, I believe it was last weekend Councilwoman Scott took the mayor on a ride-along through her district, through the western portion of her district. She'll take him, she's invited him to do the same thing in February in the southwestern portion of the district, District 1. People may forget sometimes it's not just a West Louisville district, it mm-hmm. stretches all the way down to through St. Denis, through parts of southwestern Jefferson County. So she's invited him to take part in that in February and really to give him more, I guess, visual of what the actual problem is when you have boarded up houses. Councilwoman Scott explained to me that it's not just an economic issue. It's also an issue of crime, that when you have blight in the neighborhood, people usually think that, well, there's a, you know, a bad part of the neighborhood as far as an abandoned property in that one area, maybe you don't take care of your property as much. So it does sort of draw in criminal activity, according to her. I haven't seen any statistics that bear that information out, but that generally is a thought process among council members, that abandoned properties aren't just an economic issue that puts the districts in jeopardy as far as finances and the economy, but it also is an issue of crime and blight as well.
All right, you're listening to State of the News on WFPL, and we're talking with our WFPL news team about the week's events. We welcome your participation at 502-814-TALK. That's 502-814-8255. Or you can call us toll-free, 1-877-814-TALK. That's 877-814-8255. Devin Katayama, you've been reporting on a controversy in Mercer County, Kentucky, regarding an autistic student who was placed in a bag at a school. What's going on?
This story gained national attention pretty quickly. It happened about a month ago. A mother of an autistic student showed up at Mercer County Intermediate School. The school called her and said her son was misbehaving, and this happens a lot with autistic kids. They need to be calmed down by somebody that they know, and she had been called before for situations like this. When she showed up, her son was in a therapeutic bag used to kind of relieve pressure, which is a common treatment for many autistic students. But the person who was in charge of the student, first off, he was out in the hall instead of the usual rooms they might use for these kind of therapeutic, you know, things. But the person who was in charge did not have a certification, was not a certified teacher. I used to work with autistic students myself. Teachers can pass over responsibility if they feel it's in the best interest or if they feel comfortable with the situation. So the mother was very, kind of concerned that the person who was put in charge was not somebody who, should be responsible in that situation. Now, she gained about 180,000, last time I checked, 180,000 signatures from a petition online on change.org. And the petition was formed by somebody in Massachusetts, or a Boston native, a Georgetown student, an 18-year-old with autism as well. She went to the Mercer County School Board last night and presented that to the school board. She asked that the person, the teacher's assistant, kind of either be fired or be dealt with or receive some sort of training. Now, the school board and the local districts are responsible for kind of professional development and seeing that this training is done. But for the most part, it's up to the teachers to pass over that responsibility.
And the school board is saying, well, we really can't say a lot about it, but we're not getting all the facts, the public.
Exactly. In fact, that's something that they really stressed. They can't really talk about it publicly for many reasons. One, it's a little inappropriate. The student has been pulled out of the school and is going to homeschool at this moment. Mm-hmm. And the mother's considering whether to put her back in Mercer County. But also the report that the mother gave does not really, it's not really accurate according to the report that the board has. Mm-hmm. They do have video of the incident in the hallway. However, the mother has yet to see that video. So it's still a little unclear what the full story is. But I thought that was an interesting part of the story, with the fact that you can pass over responsibility. So there will be some sort of discussion about that in the future.
I didn't know anything about these therapeutic bags and these things that
there's a lot of different therapies that teachers and therapists can use for students with autism. There's several different kinds, and a lot of the times, for somebody who doesn't know much about them, they might seem very obscure. Yeah. But they're proven to kind of relieve some of the stress or the pressure and things that autistic students experience. Now, I spoke with somebody at U of L, with James Taylor, who works with Kentucky Autism Training Center. He says that parents and schools should have communication, so the parents should know what is in the student's individual education plan and what should be applied to the student. So the mother was not aware that this was going to be applied in this situation.
All right. Thanks, Devin. Erica Peterson, Kentucky's first sandhill crane hunting season is now on the books. It's over. How did it go?
Well, that kind of depends who you ask, I guess. The Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife had a quota for this, and this was the first sandhill crane hunting season ever. In 100 years, pretty much since we've had hunting, regulations on the books, and this is the first time that the population of eastern sandhill cranes has been hunted. People can go out west and hunt sandhill cranes during different seasons in different states, but the eastern population has been pretty much left alone for a century. The state felt that the population had recovered a lot from some low levels, and it was ready to be hunted again. So the state had a quota of about 400 birds. That was the limit that could be hunted during this hunting season, and about 50 were killed.
So, what does the state think of those numbers?
Well, they say it's a success. They say, this was the first one ever. They thought it went well, and 50 birds is not, it's an eighth of what they had kind of budgeted for this. But they say it's still a success.
And environmental groups, they're...
Well, they didn't want these birds hunted in the first place. Mm-hmm. So many people have been commenting on Twitter and Facebook and saying that 50 birds is still too much. But there was some question, too, about how many of the permits that were granted were actually legit permits. The state, I think they allowed 400... They were expecting a lottery. So they said, we're going to give out 400 hunting permits for these sandhill cranes. And, you know, if more people apply, we'll just have a lottery. And they gave out 300 some. They didn't have enough interest to actually hold a lottery. But an environmental activist who was kind of protesting against this hunt told me that a number of the permits that had been granted were to people who had no intention of hunting the birds. They had applied for the permits to basically, you know, take the permits away from people who wanted to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So out of 300 some people, 50 birds, you know, it's not a huge number, but for some it's still too much.
So is it too early to tell if there'll be another hunting season next year?
They plan to. It's planned to be a 3-year experimental hunting period. So they're going to do it next year and the year after, and then kind of reassess whether it's something they want to keep doing in Kentucky.
All right. Thanks, Erica. Gabe Bullard, we've been talking, reporting seems like for several years now about the methamphetamine problem
mm-hmm.
here in Louisville, and another bill moving through the General Assembly in Frankfurt. What kind of implications would it have for us here?
Well, there are a couple bills right now, or there's two approaches, at least. One bill's gaining a little more traction than the other to fighting meth production. Lawmakers and law enforcement are focusing on pseudoephedrine. That's in Sudafed, a lot of over-the-counter cold medicines. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty common decongestion. But it's also the key ingredient in meth. And so one proposal that's been out there for a while that Oregon and Mississippi have both adopted in recent years is to make pseudoephedrine medicines available by prescription only for everyone. Opponents say that you'd have to have... that, you know, that's going to put an undue pressure on anyone who has a cold. They would have to go to the doctor if they wanted to get this type of decongestant that they wanted. There's a proposal that came out last year in Kentucky and is gaining a little bit of traction again this year that would only make convicts, people who have been convicted of a meth-related crime, have a prescription for pseudoephedrine medicines. And so Brent Yontz is sponsoring that in the House. He says it's going to be a little easier on families, and he has a lot of the pharmaceutical industry behind him on this. One question, though, and he had a conference call about this issue earlier in the week, is he often says, well, prescription abuse is rampant already in Kentucky, so it wouldn't be difficult for someone to get around that prescription requirement. But I had asked him, if that's the case, wouldn't someone who is already intent on making an illegal drug be more likely to go around the prescription anyway? He said that's true, and he said part of his bill is going to hinge on making CASPER, the state's prescription tracking system, a little bit more intense to make it able to track these prescriptions a little bit more and just improve monitoring in general. It is a way to crack down on these pill mills, as they call them, and that's something that the Attorney General's office has been working on. That's something Yontz is not working directly on, but it's something that he is hoping passes, that other lawmakers have taken up.
This has been a high-profile issue. There have been ads and whatnot and from both sides.
Yeah, definitely. And there was an ad campaign even in Louisville. I think the city got a grant for it a number of years ago that you know, showed things like an empty soda bottle, expired batteries, things like that, and said they used this to make meth and encouraged people, if they, you know, saw in a trash can, in a neighbor's trash can, or in their apartment building garbage somewhere, or just out and about generally, an odd-looking abused soda bottle, something like that, batteries that have been stripped down, a lot of cold medicine containers, that would be something to report to the police, since meth is a problem in certain parts of Louisville.
All right. Thanks, Gabe. Philip, we'll finish with you, because Muhammad Ali turned 70 years old this week, and he was honored, among other things, with a big party at the Ali Center, but also on the floor of the House by Congressman Yarmuth.
Yes, Congressman Yarmuth passed or introduced the Muhammad Ali Legacy Act, which will basically give $15 million over 3 years to a federal program that will be administered by the State Department and other federal agencies to promote what he considers Ali's legacy of global communication, understanding. It's sort of another nod to the champ in that way, since him being a Louisville native. We still haven't seen a Hunter S. Thompson one that he had talked about years ago when he first ran for Congress. I think that might be a little more difficult to get through. But no, certainly given you, if you think about Ali, what he originated as, someone who was had a revolutionary spirit and was considered a radical and probably one of the more hated men in America, that's certainly gone 180 degrees in a different direction now. no word if that legislation has passed or not, but that act certainly is a demonstration of Ali's representation not only here in Louisville, but across the globe.
All right. Thanks to our WFPL news team and our mostly Metro News Roundup, but Metro and beyond. Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip Bailey, and Devin Katayama. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thanks, Ryan. Thank you.
Time for our first break. When we come back, Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief Kenny Colston joins us. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the Kentucky General Assembly continues in Frankfort, going full steam in the 60-day session. And joining us to talk about it is Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, how are you doing, Rick?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Pretty good.
Well, we've been talking about redistricting. We reported that the governor just a while back announced that he has signed the redistricting bill into law, but obviously not everyone is happy with every element of it.
No, they're not. Obviously, House Republicans are very unhappy with the bill because up to 10 of their own members are going to be put in races against each other, or in one's case against the majority floor leader in that chamber. In the Senate, Senate Democrats are not happy. They're the minority party in that chamber. A bunch of their own members are put into races against each other, or once again in that chamber, one of their members is put against the majority floor leader in the Senate. So not everyone's happy, and a lot of people in Lexington are really upset because their state senator, Kathy Stein, is being moved. Her district is being moved to northeastern Kentucky, and basically she's going to have to sit out for 2 years, and she's being eliminated from the Senate.
Or she would have to move, I guess, right?
Well, she's kind of ruled out moving, so yeah. She might challenge it in court. She has a few other options, she said. She might run for her House seat again in Lexington, but when it comes to the Senate, she's pretty much out of luck.
And so the governor has signed this, and it takes effect immediately, I guess.
Yes, it does. Those new judicial lines, the new House, the new Senate lines, all of them are in effect. The filing deadline is January 31st at 4 p.m. Eastern time. You have to file here at the Secretary of State's office in Frankfort. So those are pretty much set. What's not set is the congressional district redistricting lines.
I see. Where do we stand on that? Is that in a conference committee?
It is in conference committee, but it doesn't seem like it's progressing quickly at all. They were supposed to meet today for conference committee day two. We got word that they decided not to meet today. House Speaker Greg Stumbo says that they are very far apart on a compromise. Both sides are pointing fingers at each other. Speaker Stumbo says that, you know, in order to compromise, both sides have to come to the middle, and pretty much no one gets what they want. And the Senate has responded. Senator Stivers has said that if the House wants a compromise, they're going to have to be reasonable. So they're pointing fingers. They're not really close. They're supposed to meet again on Monday. Maybe they can hammer out a deal by then, but that seems unlikely.
Conference committee, of course, for those who don't know, is House and Senate lawmakers get together and try to iron out the differences in their respective bills. Well, the Governor Beshear delivered his budget address this week. As expected, he's calling for some deep cuts. How is that being received in the two chambers?
Well, you know, House Speaker Greg Stumbo said that he doesn't believe the Governor Beshear's budget will be changed much at all. It's a very tough budget, cuts of 8.4% to most state agencies. Higher education has a 6.4% cut. Even state police are cut 2.2%. And the speaker says that based on those numbers, there's not a lot you can do. I mean, giving a 1% increase in K-12 education, let's say, means millions of dollars that the state doesn't have. The Senate is a little bit more cautious. Both Senate President David Williams and their budget chairman, Senator Leeper, have said that they're going to wait and see what the bill actually says, the budget bill actually says, and what the House does before they really come out and say what they want to do with it. But Stumbo has already gone on the record multiple times and saying he doesn't see how either chamber can change the budget that much.
How was the gambling amendment proceeding that the governor is proposing?
You know, it's kind of stalled, to be honest with you. Earlier this week, the Family Foundation said that the governor was short 3 votes in the Senate, which is where the governor is trying to push the amendment through first. And on Tuesday, when we spoke to the governor about his budget, That was brought up, and someone asked him, you know, are you counting votes? And he said, we count every day. And they said, is the Family Foundation correct? You know, are you short votes? And the governor basically said, we hope to, you know, introduce an amendment in the next couple of weeks. Didn't give a real firm answer that the Family Foundation was lying about not having the votes for the gambling amendment. So it's stalled. I believe the governor is still working behind the scenes, trying to get that amendment, trying to get the votes for that amendment. And hopefully, I believe he will introduce it in the next few weeks, and he hopes he has the votes. But it seems to be very, very fluid.
And he mentioned in his address that obviously this wouldn't be a panacea, but it would give us some much-needed revenue.
Yeah, that's what he said in his budget address, that and tax reform. You know, there's been a lot of studies that have been published that say, you know, the revenue could be in the billions, that say a lot of people want to vote on this issue. All interested parties have been working it back and forth, and that's how you know that something is churning in the works behind the scenes. It's just a matter of how many votes there are. I mean, normally you wouldn't come out and say this proposal is this many votes short or that many votes short. That's kind of revealing a hand that allows the governor and supporters of expanded gambling to kind of come on and say and target specific people. But it's definitely a fight behind the scenes, and once redistricting is finished and we get through the budget, I think you'll see a lot of gambling talked about here in the chambers.
The new agriculture commissioner, James Comer, has come out in favor of legalizing industrial hemp in Kentucky. What kind of legislative support might he have for that?
He has a little legislative support for that. I mean, he's got bipartisan support. He has two Democrats that are the majority in the House that are following the bill and trying to push it. He has a Democratic senator in the Senate, although that's the minority party, Senator Pendleton, who's been a big advocate of this. Obviously, James Comer has a lot of pull with Republicans, being the only Republican to win statewide this past year. So I think he'll try to push the bill. You know, the saying goes that it usually takes three or four chances in Frankfurt for a bill to finally, you know, really get heard and passed. So I don't know that this session will be the one, but the commissioner has obviously put it out there. He's trying to kind of reverse some of these myths about industrial hemp, that it's, you know, it's close to marijuana, and it's really not, is what they're saying. And he's kind of saying this could help a hurting agriculture industry in Kentucky that's hurt by the reduction of tobacco and how big of a cash crop that is. So he's pushing that bill. We'll have to see how far it really goes.
And Kentucky was once a leader in industrial hemp production.
Yes, it was. A long time ago it was, and it was funny in the press conference yesterday. There were quotes from Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, very historical about Henry Ford, how he wanted to look into hemp production for car parts, and how Kentucky's auto industry, BMW, is currently working with hemp in making trunk lids and stuff like that, and that with three automakers here in Kentucky, obviously Ford, GM, and Toyota, that, you know, hemp production here, industrial hemp production here, could really help those auto industries, could help in textile industry as well, and that's the push behind it.
Commissioner Comer's predecessor, Richie Farmer, has been in the news lately. There's reports that he did not return some his state-issued equipment from his tenure as agriculture commissioner. Now it's been reported that he has given some of that stuff back.
Yes, he has given, I think, two of the four laptops that are missing, a few other small items, but he hasn't given it all back yet. Those were immediately turned over to Auditor Adam Edelin, who is auditing the Agriculture Department at Comer's request. So I don't know that we'll hear a lot about it. Usually auditors like to keep their cards close to the vest. But, you know, a few things have been returned. I'm sure if they find the rest of them, they will be returned and kept in storage at the auditor's office. That'll be something we'll have to continue to track as Auditor Edelin continues to audit that department.
There was also a push on, again, this session for a statewide smoking ban.
Yes, Susan Westrom, a Lexington representative, and the Kentucky Chamber and a bunch of medical and health officials had a press conference where, you know, the American Lung Association released its state report card, and Kentucky once again got an F in all categories when it comes to tobacco control. And a lot of urban and metro cities and counties have smoking bans, but the idea is that you would have a statewide smoking ban, and that that way restaurants, like you see here in Louisville, like you've seen in Lexington, that would do restaurants and in public areas. And the idea is that, you know, some of these communities in the restaurants really want to go smoke-free, but there's public pressure not to do it, is what Westrom said. And so having a statewide ban kind of relieves pressure on businesses to make that decision to offend people. She said the odds of it passing this session are about 50-50. It's been proposed the session beforehand, so once again, going back to the third time's a charm, I think this is the second time she's pushed it, so it might get a little bit further, but it does have the support of the business community.
You're listening to State of the News on WFPL, and we're talking with Kenny Colston, the Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief. Also a bill, Kenny, making its way through the legislature again, and this has had the support of First Lady Jane Beshear, is a bill that would raise the dropout age in Kentucky.
Yeah, there, that bill is once again Representative Greer in the House. That made it through committee this week. It is yet to be passed off the House floor, but there's probably little doubt that it will. The main hurdle is in the state Senate. And it appears that there might be some opportunity for this bill to pass through the state Senate if it's amended. Now, what that amendment may be, will it be attacking or attaching technical and career education to that bill? You know, Senator Westwood has a bill that just has career and technical education to it. I think the Senate Committee, Education Committee, will talk about whether they just want to push the career and technical education bill separate, whether they want to merge it with a dropout bill. Senator Higdon in the Senate is sponsoring a similar bill to the House version that is a dropout bill. And so I think this is finally going to make – it could make the steps to make it into law after being pushed by the governor and the first lady for quite a few years.
A couple of other things before we let you go, Kenny. There's an effort to make the – is it the University of Pikeville, is it known now?
Yes.
That would make it a part of the state university system?
Yes, that is correct. That bill has been filed this week. It didn't really contain anything that we didn't know before. The interesting part is in his budget, Governor Beshear has left a unspecified amount of co-severance funds, which is what Speaker Stumbaugh wants to use to pay the University of Pikeville to make them a public university. And he said in his address that he's leaving open the ability for them to use some of that coal severance money, uncommitted money, and use it to bring the University of Pikeville into the state system. I find that interesting. It's not a full endorsement from the governor about the University of Pikeville, but it's certainly an olive branch, certainly meeting halfway to leave that money uncommitted, and not only that, but to specifically point it out and say, hey, you know, you all are thinking about this, and here's this amount of money that you all have been talking about $13 million. I'm going to leave it uncommitted, and if you all want to bring the University of Pikeville along to the state system, it's up to you guys.
All right, and finally, lawmakers have been urging Kentuckians and those interested to donate to a state breast cancer research fund.
Yes, that's correct. If on your income tax returns, it's box 36. If you check that box, you can donate any amount of money you want to a breast cancer research fund. And a lot of state lawmakers were basically encouraging people to do that this year. One state lawmaker said that if half of Kentucky's taxpayers donated $10 a year, that would be over $9 million donated to the fund annually to help research and eventually eliminate breast cancer in Kentucky. So that was another issue that, you know, a lot of lawmakers were pushing that isn't really, you know, a tough, you know, battle over this bill or that bill.
All right, Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio, Frankfort Bureau Chief, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Last week, U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky traveled to Myanmar for what was described as an emotional meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi, the longtime democracy leader who spent 15 years under house arrest in that country, where the military regime seems to be now apparently willing to accept some reforms. Here to tell us about it is Jim Carroll from the Courier-Journal's Washington Bureau. Welcome, Jim.
Happy Friday to you.
Same to you. Well, democracy in Myanmar and the plight of Aung San Suu Kyi are something that McConnell has worked to keep in the kind of the world's consciousness, I guess, for a long time. Why is it so important to him?
Well, he really got interested in the late 80s when there were some this military regime has been around in one form or another since the early 60s. And in the late 80s, there was one of the occasional public displays of dissatisfaction with the regime, and there was a major crackdown on demonstrators there. And McConnell got interested at that time in the problems in Burma, and really has a lot of times been trying to, you know, bring public attention to this, you know, against the current of other news, and really has just pushed and pushed and pushed and tried to get this this nation of 55 million people, you know, much more in the public view, both here in the United States and, of course, across the world. And, you know, he told me in his office before he left, his trip was over last weekend, but he told me in his office before he left, you know, he never really thought that the day would come where he would see anything significant changing. But it appears that some changes are underway there.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he's the first U.S. congressional leader to visit the country, right?
The first leader. There's been a couple other members of Congress, including John McCain, who preceded him. But yes, he's the first congressional leader to be there. And of course, he followed by about a month Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's visit to Burma as well, to Myanmar. It's also known as Burma.
What's the status of Aung San Suu Kyi? She's no longer under house arrest, but isn't obviously not traveling outside the country.
Well, she's not yet, because I guess it's not really clear if she left whether they'd ever let her back in. That was the problem for many years. They were the regime was very, I think, probably anxious to have her leave because then they would deny her reentry to the country. As things are liberalizing, I use that term advisedly, but at least as things are starting to change, she is traveling about the country. She is planning to run for one of the parliamentary seats in the April by-elections that are coming up. April 1st is the date on that. Her party will then participate in the, presumably she will win, and she'll win several other seats. They'll participate in the new parliament after that. This is still a military-backed civilian regime, but Suu Kyi herself told McConnell that she believes that the leadership of the government is serious about making reforms. He is the president of Myanmar. Thein Sein has actually hosted Suu Kyi at his home. So, you know, there seems to be some rapprochement going on there. And McConnell told me later that after he met with her and met with the president that, you know, it really appears that there are substantive changes afoot and that everybody seems to be talking from the same page. That doesn't mean there aren't great obstacles still ahead, but things are changing.
And the senator has extended an invitation for her to visit here in Louisville.
That's right. He'd like her to come, I think, as well to Washington, certainly to address Congress, and he would like to have her at the McConnell Center in Louisville, obviously. That would be a major moment for him. He has tried to have some communications with her over the years. Of course, when she was under house arrest, that was nearly impossible. He did have one letter from her around, I think, 2002 or so. But when they finally met, I guess it was a very emotional experience for him and for her. They had talked a couple, I think, three times in the last couple of months on the telephone. Now they've met in person, so they're obviously able to have more conversations back and forth. But this is something very very important to McConnell, and obviously he would love to, when the time is appropriate, and you know, she can be assured that she will not be shut out of her own country. He would love to have her here and host her.
Now, last time we talked to you, you were in New Hampshire with the Ron Paul campaign. Obviously,
you
haven't followed him down to South Carolina.
No, Ron Paul is down there. Senator Rand Paul has been pretty much busy in making appearances in different parts of Kentucky this past week, so he's not been down there with his father. According to some of the accounts I've seen, Ron Paul's campaign down there, while active, the candidate himself has had kind of a laid-back schedule, and it's not an intense competition as far as he's concerned down there. But he is focusing out ahead on some of the caucuses that are coming up, where Paul's campaign in the past has proved to be very effective. So we'll have to see how that comes out.
Should be an interesting weekend this weekend.
Yes, South Carolina. Are you making any guesses?
No. How about you?
Me neither. No, I've given up on that.
I was going to give it to Romney.
I'm still hoping the Patriots will win on Sunday. That's the only thing I'm focused on that I'm pretty sure about.
Good plan. All right, Jim Carroll, the Courier-Journal, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is State of the News on WFPL. When we come back, we'll talk about Fall City Beer, the return of Fall City Beer with the Courier-Journal's Joe Girth. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. Louisville was once home to more than two dozen breweries, and not surprising, given the city's German heritage. Today, many Louisvillians of a certain age have firsthand knowledge of perhaps Fair's, Ertl's 92, and the last and perhaps best-known brand from that era, Fall City Beer. Remember the ad slogan, "Nobody makes us make beer this good." Fall City, when you live like you should. Well, here to talk about it is Joe Girth, who wrote about Fall City last week in the Courier-Journal as the brand is making a return to Louisville. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Great.
Well, those of us who have been around for a few years remember Fall City being as much a part of the Louisville as the Ohio River. Some argued kind of late in Fall City's life that it kind of tasted like the Ohio River, but we'll get to that later. Let's start with, when did Fall City begin and why did it go away?
You know, it began back in the early part of the 20th century, and it was created by largely bar owners who had been kind of under the thumb of the other brewery operators. They often not only sold them their beer, but they also owned the land where their bars were located, and they were really putting the screws to them. And so someone got the bright idea, hey, let's start our own beer brand. And that's where Fall City came from. At the height of production, they were making about 750,000 barrels of beer a year back in the early to mid 70s. They were distributed in, I believe, 8 states in the region. It was a very, very strong brand. But as increased pressure came from other beer companies, you know, Schlitz, Stroh's, Pabst were some of the big beer companies that had strong sales in the Louisville area back at that time, forced to go to cheaper and cheaper products and ultimately sold out. First to the Evansville Brewing Company, and they shipped production to the Sterling plant in Evansville. Then later, the ownership of the brand went to a Pittsburgh Brewing Company, where the brand died a few years ago.
So who's bringing it back?
Well, it's a computer software entrepreneur by the name of David Easterling, who isn't originally from Louisville, lives in Louisville now, but he just started learning about Fall City a little bit. You know, you've got signs still at three bars in some of the old neighborhoods outside that say have the old oval Fall City
the logo.
Logo, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he started looking into it and found out that, hey, the trademark had lapsed on Fall City. They would hire a lawyer to take over that trademark, and then a couple of years ago he started producing beer. Right now they've got an English ale out. It's very similar to a Bass or something of that nature. Not real hoppy. It's a fairly smooth drink, and it's tons different than the old lager that Fall City produced in its later years.
Yeah, it kind of went into decline in its later years, a little watered down, it seems.
Yeah, and it just, you talk to people, it didn't have much taste to it at all. My grandfather was quite often a Fall City drinker. In fact, my first beer in a bar may have been with him when I was well underage. and it was a Fall City. But the interesting thing about Fall City is it had started as an ale type beer. They also produced a dark beer, a box, several other different kinds of beers back before Prohibition. But when they emerged from Prohibition, they began making the lager beer that over time apparently became weaker and weaker and less flavorful. At the time that it died, it just didn't have the greatest reputation in the world.
Got about a minute left. I was surprised to read in your article that Fall City was the first to use the stay tab, and also I knew this, that it produced Billy Beer at the height of President Carter's administration, and of course his brother Billy Carter.
Right, and on the label itself, it said that it was It was chosen, the flavor of the beer was chosen by one of the world's greatest beer drinkers. So,
all right, Joe Girth of the Courier-Journal. You can read his article about Falls City Beer. It appeared, January 14th, I believe.
You're looking at calendar. I'm not, so I'll take your word on that.
Well, just do a search. You'll find it online on the Courier-Journal's website. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great talking to you, and have a great one, Rick. All right.
Thanks, Joe. See you.
Bye-bye.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's topics, visit our website, WFPL.org. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, Devin Katayama, Graham Shelby, Rick Howlett. Our production team is led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Joe Durso is at the controls. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.